Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy brought to you every Friday night here on KCRW, and it has been brought to you every Friday night here for the last 5 years, and that's what the show is about. We're celebrating 5 years on the air here. Oh, my goodness. It's over 200 shows, probably close to 250 shows. It's pretty incredible. I used to run into people who told me that they saved tapes of every show that I did, and I'm sure that there are none of you out there that are still doing that. Even I have no copies. I mean, I don't have copies of every single show, but I have saved copies of the very special ones, the glorious memories that I have, and that's what we'll be listening to today, is highlights of some of the special shows that have gone on over these 5 years. Specifically, the interview shows with Bill Scott and June Foray, the voice of Rocky and Bullwinkle, Garrison Keillor, the host of Prairie Home Companion, and John Cleese of Fawlty Towers and Monty Python fame. And we'll start off with the Rocky and Bullwinkle interview. It happened about, 3 years ago or so. And Bill Scott was a wonderful man. He has unfortunately since passed away. June Foray is thankfully still with us and still very active in the world of cartoon voices. She is Jokey Smurf on The Smurfs, among other things. And they talked about Rocky and Bullwinkle. And I'll tell you, there's something really unsettling about sitting across a table from a perfectly normal-looking man. Actually sort of resembled Charlie Weaver, if you remember that. A pretty nice-looking older man who opens his mouth and suddenly sounds more like Bullwinkle than you can imagine anybody sounding like Bullwinkle. I mean, everybody has known people that do Bullwinkle, but it was amazing. So anyhow, here's how that show opened up. Well, this, for the first time in KCRW history, we have actually had to rent microphones because we didn't have enough microphones or even barely enough space in the studio to hold all of the people that are in here. I suppose I should go around the room and introduce them one by one. First of all, there's Marigold.
Well, hello there.
And Tom Slick.
Greetings there, people.
George of the Jungle.
George, here too. Swing from tree.
Oh! A Super Chicken.
Well, I'm certainly glad you mentioned me, if not first, at least.
Nell Fenwick.
Oh, Dudley, he must be here, too, with the horse.
And he is. Hello, Dudley.
Dudley, too bad that the Mountie's here. The only Mountie ever to arrest a redwood tree. For loitering.
Mr. Peabody?
Yes, of course. My, he is an oaf, isn't he, that Dudley?
And Natasha Fatal?
Always glad to be here. Not glad to be here. Sad to be here.
Rocky the Flying Squirrel?
Hokey smoke, me too. I'm where Bullwinkle is.
And the one and only Bullwinkle Moose.
Or as he is sometimes known, absolutely befuddled.
Otherwise known as the collective voices of June Foray and Bill Scott. Welcome to KCRW, guys.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Bob.
Well, you want me to speak in my own voice? This is it, kiddo.
I then asked them about some of the lawsuits that they got, specifically one with Durward Kirby. They did a show about the Kirward Derby, and here's what happened.
We got a letter from Durward Kirby's attorney. You know, he said, Mr. Kirby feels that so-and-so, and you will cease and desist, or we will be forced to take legal action. Jay wrote back a letter and said, if Mr. Kirby will sue us, we will pay his attorney's fees.
That's wonderful.
We heard no more about it. And we got the great Klemke Diddlehopper story. At the time, in order to give the show topicality, because there's such a lag in animation, we used a hand puppet on network, live hand puppet. Mm-hmm. I was doing the hand puppet and the voice, and we got this letter from Red Skelton's attorney, and he said, Mr. Skelton feels that you have stolen his voice of Klemke Diddlehopper to use for Bullwinkle. You will cease and desist, or we will take legal action. And that night, the puppet goes on the air, and he says,
see, we get a letter in the mail today from Mr. Ben Skelton. He said that my voice sounds like that of Klemke Diddlehopper. Now, to show you just how silly that is, I will now do my imitation of Klemke Diddlehopper. Hi there, this is Klemke Diddlehopper speaking. Now, you see how different?
We didn't hear anything more. I think these are the people, the principals involved were not all that concerned about it.
So when these shows were first aired, there were also live segments?
Yes. The puppet was live. And
is there any,
as a matter of fact,
any of that could still
When we shifted from NBC to ABC, we had a special notation the puppets said. So as a parting gesture to NBC, we roasted their peacock. And we brought this scrawny dead bird on the air. There was one occasion on which we were taken to task because we had used a standard, what I thought was a standard cartoon ploy. Rocky and Bullwinkle are captured by natives and they are put into a pot, right? And the fire is lit under them and the network screamed bloody murder. And they said, "You can't. No cannibalism on children's shows." Jay fired off a letter asking for a philosophical decision on whether it was cannibalism to eat a moose and a squirrel.
That's great.
And
how was it resolved?
Well, we were so close to air.
In the pot.
Yeah. The next thing they objected to was the natives themselves. They said, "You can't do this. You know, the NAACP is going to get after us." So from that point on, all of our natives were always white. We had the whitest natives. They all had funny costumes on. They all talked crazy, but they were all white.
And speaking of natives, Bill Conrad kept saying, "I can double. Why don't you ever let me double?
I can do voices. I can do voices as well as any of these bastards."
Because he was way up here when he talked. And, you know, he wanted to use his own voice. So Bill obviously wrote a line just for Bill Conrad. Sam the Native. What did he say? Ug me go.
He's a minor supporting character, right?
And it was not good. There on in, he was never allowed to double again.
We had this one session, and of course, Freeze just ragged him unmercifully. He read the thing. He sounded just like Bill Conrad. Jay said, "Sounds like Bill Conrad, Bill. Can you change it a little bit?" So he read it again. "Now, can we try a little higher, maybe?" And he read it again. And by this time, we're beginning to break up. Conrad is perspiring. He's going to get the goddamn money. He's going to get it. It kills him, man. At that point, Paul Free says, "You know, Billy, why don't you try with a French accent?" Hey, Conrad, it's getting sore. I think we finally did it. I don't know whether we actually took the tape. He must have done that particular episode, that line, at least 25 times.
They were ragging him, too.
Yeah, and the people in the booth are falling down, and we're going hysterical, and Conrad is determined he's going to get something he can use on the air. The next day, Jay, through our publicity man, planted an article in the trades that said, "Scuttlebutt is that a major network is dickering with actor William Conrad for an animated series to be called Sam the Native." And Bill was getting all kinds of phone calls. "Say, I hear you're Sam the Native. Gee, that's great."
Sam the Native. That's marvelous. And marvelous was the experience of meeting and interviewing June Foray and Bill Scott. Now let's get on to Garrison Keillor. This was a very different sort of interview. First of all, it took place in his hotel room at some ungodly early hour of the morning, and you'll hear traffic noises outside as a result. And it was interesting because I've always thought Garrison Keillor had the most wonderful voice on the radio. And when I was interviewing him, I must have been 3 or 4 feet away from him, and his voice sounded very sort of groggy and faint, as it does, as people's voices sound early in the morning. And I was thinking, well, it's a shame that we won't have that wonderful voice. And then I went back and listened to the tape, and there it was. There's just something magical about the reaction that takes place between his voice and a microphone, as you will now hear. And we'll start off with his discussion of his early days as a writer.
I intended to write for newspapers, and I pursued that right up until the time I worked for a newspaper, the St. Paul Pioneer Press. I dropped out of college to go to work for them. And it was a wonderful job. I loved it. I did everything. I wrote obituaries. I was the guy who called down to the hospital to see if the people who'd been hurt in the car crashes had died and should be added to the highway toll or could be left on the list of the living. I interviewed visiting celebrities, including a few visiting authors, each one more boring than the last. I did all this stuff. And I suppose that I could have earned my living as a newspaper reporter, but as wonderful as the life was, I really did want to write something that was more my own, and that was freer, and that turned out to be humor, to be comic fiction. And I published, it was just a few years after I worked for the newspaper that I published a story with the New Yorker, and so that kind of led me off down that path.
Your monologues are designed to give the impression that you're just up there chatting off the cuff about the news from your hometown, but most of us know better. Tell me a little bit about the preparation that goes into the monologues.
I write as much as I can. I don't worry too much about the order. I just want to get as much material down on paper as I possibly can. I've been a writer for so long that writing is my method of thinking. It's my method of organizing myself. I sit down to write in order to find out how I feel about things, you see. Writing is not exactly a craft for me. That is a work of the intelligence, a work of cleverness, of taking what you already have and putting it in order. Writing is much more a process of self-discovery. So that's what I go through in order to do the news from Lake Wobegon. I write as much as I possibly can without any attempt to write a script, really, or to get set, but just to give myself a head start. And then when I go out on stage, I want to be free to work from that or to make up things and go beyond it.
More than most entertainers, you give your listeners the feeling that they really know you very well and that you're an old friend. How well do your listeners really know you, and what about you would surprise them the most?
I think that they know me pretty well. I also think that the people who listen to the show know that when you step out on stage, you put your best self forward in a way. I mean, you certainly spare your audience some of the violence that all of us contain, the anger and sort of shapeless, formless unhappiness that we carry around with us. We don't do those out on stage, not in my line of work. Not for long. Though I suppose you find ways to use those things. Perhaps that's what would surprise people about me the most, though I would hope not. I would hope not. I mean, I yell at people, you know. I mean, I have. I don't do it every day. I don't do it as a rule, but I have. I've had fights with people who are very near and dear to me and whom I love dearly, which I'm glad there are no tape recordings of, because it wasn't a proud moment, you know.
Yeah.
And fights that, as I look back on them and think about them, seem utterly irrational, foolish, and I feel ashamed for them.
I have a tape of one of those right here.
Oh, great.
We'll broadcast it. You were chosen by the Funny Stuff audience as the funniest person working today. There were two categories. There's the funniest stuff still working and still working in comedy.
Your audience, Bob, is made up of shut-ins, I guess, who don't get out often.
Most radio audiences are people in cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the other category was the funniest person who ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing that a question this momentous requires a great deal of thought, just off the cuff, who would you have voted for?
As the funniest
person that ever lived, and the funniest person that's still working.
Uh-huh. Well, I think probably Christ might have been the funniest person who ever lived. I think God has a tremendous sense of humor. But you probably are talking about human folks. The funniest person working today.
What would the funniest thing that Christ ever did be, do you think?
I think some of the miracles were humorous. With the pigs, the pig routine where he put the evil spirits into the pigs and the pigs took off for the cliff. Let me think. Funniest person of all time. I'll bet it's somebody who we don't even know. Somebody, I would guess, probably somebody who lived in North Dakota would be the funniest person. And that person just went into town once a week or once every other week and sat around and had a couple beers with people at the tavern and achieved such a perfection of humor that nobody realized how funny it was.
You're still a relatively young man considering your accomplishments to this point. Do you have any unfulfilled ambitions?
I want to live in a country where they don't speak English, and I want to do that for a while and learn another language. I have lived in Minnesota all my life, and so of course I've lived in America all my life. I haven't really gone far beyond this country. And I think America is so isolated from other people, and it's bad for us as individuals. I have an urge to get out of the Midwest and live in some strange place and have to learn a strange language.
Like New York, for
instance. No, farther than that. And then I think if I went and did that and lived where they didn't speak English, I'd probably start writing a wonderful book about Minnesota and write the book that it really is worthy of.
So there it is. You heard it first. Although it was one of the big news stories of 1987 that Garrison Keillor quit A Prairie Home Companion to go to Norway and then to New York. Back in September of 1985, he told you, the Funny Stuff audience, that he was going to do just that, and I'm not going to take credit for telling him to go to New York, but you heard it yourself, and you judge for yourself. Now on to John Cleese. John Cleese was the most wonderful interview imaginable. He was just delightful and easygoing and answered all the questions and told me wonderful stories, and it's almost impossible to pick out 10 minutes from that we can play for you here. But we do the impossible here on Funny Stuff. And we'll start off with his response to my asking him about the real Basil Fawlty that Fawlty Towers was based upon.
It was based on a place that we stayed when Monty Python was shooting in Torquay in 71 or 72. And this astoundingly rude man ran it, who was just like Basil, except he was very small and his wife was very big. Now, the advantage of having me and Prue playing it is that it's not so obvious that it's the henpecked husband, which is actually the kind of stereotype, the archetype under it. Because I'm big and Prue is small, people don't immediately see that. But the original guy, whose name was Sinclair, was astoundingly rude, because when Terry Gilliam was sitting at dinner one night, cutting the meat as the Americans do, you know, cutting the meat and then putting the knife on the top of the plate, moving the fork to the right hand, spearing the meat that has been cut. And this man stopped as he was going by, and he stared at Terry for about 5 seconds, if not 10, and he said, "We don't eat like that in this country." Absolutely astounding.
Does he know that he is...
Yes, because I deliberately hid the man's name from people for a number of years, but one day I told somebody that it was a guy called Sinclair who'd been at Glen Eagles Hotel, and the next thing I knew, this information had got into one of the English daily papers, the Daily Mail, and they tracked the poor so-and-so down in Miami, I think it was. house. And they actually sat his daughter down with the tapes and played the tapes. And she said, oh, yes, she said, that's just like Mum and Dad. Just a final nail in the coffin for the poor thing. But I must say he was so rude that he doesn't particularly deserve anybody not to base a comedy character. When I came to do 40 Towers, I gave Connie and myself 36 weeks to write the 6 episodes, and we took 36 weeks, and we never felt too pressured by time. And in those 36 weeks, we were able to build a lot of ideas, reasonably original ideas, and fasten them together in a reasonably satisfactory structure. You know, anyone else?
That you could do that. I know I have friends that write American television, and if you can't write an episode of situation comedy in 2 weeks, they say you're in the wrong business.
Well, and exactly. And what the trouble is, the people who say that are in the wrong business because they're the ones who are responsible for the rotten television. Mm-hmm. Because they think it has to be written. If they were all fired, and people who were put in who said take 5 weeks to write something and we'll pay you 2.5 times as much money, but it'll have to be 2.5 times better, then you'd start getting television that would be really exciting and the viewing figures would go up. They'd make more on advertising, you know. But they won't think like that.
What? When do we take over?
Well, the trouble is that folks like us don't want to do that because we don't want to be executives. So they put some of these cloth-eared idiots who don't know a good script from a bite in the arse, and they're supposed to make these decisions, and they're totally unqualified to do so. They go around parroting each other's phrases, like, if you can't write a comedy in 2 weeks, you oughtn't to be in this business, and they're the ones who oughtn't to be in it.
Yeah.
Sorry, but I felt it was time I got a little excited and said something interesting and controversial.
We'll mark it down.
Yeah, duly noted. Right. Controversial speech. Also, I'm in favor of war. Oh. I want to make a really controversial pro-war film in which I come out strongly in favor of young men blowing each other's limbs off.
Well, doesn't that contradict Privates on Parade? You'll then have to retract that.
Oh, absolutely. No, I want to do something really controversial. I decided that a pro-war movie was the way to do it, something to stir people up.
Well, there are so many of them, though. I mean, what is Rambo?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, maybe. Yes, maybe that's true. That hadn't actually struck me, but I suppose Rambo is a pro-war movie. It's certainly pro, we are the good people and entitled to kill everyone else who disagrees with this movie. What an extraordinary bit of film that is. I mean, if that isn't playing on an audience's basest instincts, what is? You know, let's all get together and kill everyone who isn't like us. Having set them up, first of all, as being frightfully evil and getting too...
But not only that, but let's do it half naked.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. I would love to do an English Rambo in which somebody, a very nice, rather restrained English accountant who's been ticked off by his wife being late for tea, goes to the cinema in a huff and sees Rambo and becomes so enraged by the sheer mindlessness of it, by the sheer adulation of violence and by the ludicrousness of the idea that problems can be solved by blowing everybody who disagrees with you to pieces, decides that he is going to kill Sylvester Stallone, strips himself to the waist, spends 4 months practicing with a sort of sharpened umbrella point, and sets off towards Hollywood, slaying large quantities of Americans, especially cops, and presumably, since those things are always populists, large numbers of American civil servants based in Washington on the way. Oh, dear. I suddenly felt very tired.
Now, here's what happened when he discussed a show that they did called the 1948 Show, starring himself and Marty Feldman and Graham Chapman. And he talks about a woman by the name of Amy McDonald, who was a running character on this show.
She used to come out, she was the archetypal showgirl, and we just kind of did her as a send-up because it was supposed to be a show business show and none of us were very show business. And she used to come out, I remember she did a wonderful joke, which I love one, she came out and she used to talk in this silly voice because actually, if she got a little bit pissed, she used to, you don't say pissed, do you? What do you mean
drunk?
Yeah. If Amy got a little bit
pissed
drunk.
Pissed means angry here.
That's right. It's pissed off in English, it's so complicated. If Amy got a little bit drunk, she would come and start, you know, really talking in quite a broad Scottish accent like this. But the moment she was sober again in the morning, she talked like this.
Oh, you see, isn't that nice? Most extraordinary voice. It's just a little bit like Anna Elk in the Python sketch.
And I remember she came out, and she used to come out and say things the audience liked.
Are you interested in astrology? I am, she'd say. My star sign is Leo. That's like Burt Lancaster. I wonder what it says in the newspapers today.
She'd open up the newspaper and she said,
here's the astrology, Leo. Your name is Amy MacDonald and you are reading out your horoscope live on television. Oh, she'd say, that's good, isn't it? And a long pause and she'd say, not very good for Burt Lancaster, though. I thought it was a wonderful joke. And we used to write this rubbish for her to link the sketches.
And now here's what he had to say about the very early days, the day that they taped the very first Monty Python show.
I mean, the great moment for me was about 4 minutes into the first show when the audience started to laugh, because I can still remember saying to dear Michael Palin in the dressing rooms just 10 minutes before the first recording ever took place, I remember saying to him so clearly, as you see him standing there, as a photograph in my mind, saying to him, you realize we may be just about to do an entire 30-minute comedy television show, total silence. And he said, yes. He just had the same realization. And then Terry Jones and Graham Chapman went out and did the bit about the flying sheep, and the giggles started about 3 minutes in, and that was a great moment. I don't know who that is, but maybe they want to be in the interview.
It's probably Jehovah's Witnesses coming to tell
yes.
us something.
Apparently the thing to say to them is, oh good, I'm Jehovah, how much have we collected?
We can assume that the book is closed on Monty Python.
Well, I don't know, because I did say to the others some time ago, wouldn't it be fun to make another film? And they all looked at me balefully, and I added, when we're 50. And they brightened up a bit, because they thought it was a decrepit old bunch of drink-sodden, pot-bellied, balding Englishmen getting together as the rebellious young anarchistic group, you know. And I then suggested that maybe we should make a film that viciously attacked young people. You know, and health.
It's a pro-war movie. Yeah.
No, a separate project, but just attack them for being young and vigorous and healthy. And really put the boot in on them. So everybody over the age of about 38 really loved the film, and all the young people would feel picked upon and resentful. And I think that's a wonderful idea.
Wait about 4 years then.
Well, five and a half we have to wait, because Michael Palin's the youngest. He's 44 and a half. I quite like to work with them again, though. As Terry Gilliam apparently said to somebody, he said, we're much more a dining club now than a work unit.
Oh, but what a talented dining club, eh? Okay, well, that's our anniversary show featuring highlights of interviews with Bill Scott and June Foray and Garrison Keillor and John Cleese. By the way, I'm still in touch with John Cleese, and he promises that when he is next in town to publicize his next movie called A Fish Called Wanda, about which I hear terrific things, by the way, he'll pay us a return visit, and that is something that I, at least, am very much looking forward to. Looking back over 5 years of funny stuff, there are a lot of people to thank, specifically Ruth Hirschman and KCRW for putting up with us for 5 years. I'd like to thank all the people that have followed this show who have been very nice about the fact that I occasionally run into their time. So, Isabel, if you're out there and listening, especially you, thanks so much. And thanks, of course, to my wife, Kathy Claster, who has come up with lots of ideas that have been used in the show, in addition to the usual spousal support stuff. Anyhow, next week's show is going to be backstage at Comic Relief. I took a tape recorder back there and talked to a lot of the comedians and the people involved, and that should be an interesting show. I hope you can join me then. The week after that, we'll be listening to some records by Irma Bombeck and Art Buchwald. So, lots of interesting things coming up on Funny Stuff, and I hope you can join me for the next 5 years. So, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening all these years, and reminding you, as usual, to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.